Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, welcome back. I recognize you. I'm Kevin, you know me. And we're hiking today. And I've noticed that when I go by people on hikes, a lot of people are venting. Hiking is great for venting. It's not complaining, it's just venting, getting things off your chest. It's like the difference between high maintenance and getting attention. Hiking is great for venting and getting attention. I think that's what I'm really trying to say. All right, grab your protein pills, put your helmet on. We're going for a hike.
Hello, and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. My guest on this week's show is a true comedy legend, Kevin Nealon. I grew up watching Kevin anchor Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. He's an incredible stand-up comic and actor. You might know him from Weeds, and now he stars on the sitcom Man with a Plan. But the main reason I wanted to talk to Kevin is because I love his YouTube series, Hiking with Kevin. It just started its third season this past week with Alec Baldwin as the first guest, but he's talked to a lot of great people on the show, including a lot of his former SNL cast members. The show has been compared a bit to Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, including by Jerry Seinfeld, who seemed to call him out a little bit in a promo for that show when it came back this past season. I feel like an alternate title for it could be Comedians on Hikes Getting Winded. But I think it's a really interesting show, and he gets really great stuff out of his guests. And there's something kind of weirdly meditative about watching him hike around the mountains of Los Angeles with his famous friends. Before we get to Kevin, I want to remind everyone to please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what your favorite episode has been so far and who else you want to hear on the show. I know a lot of people have been enjoying the Anthony Jeselnik episode. That one was a lot of fun for me to do, and I hope you enjoyed it. So now let's go to my conversation with Kevin Nealon. Kevin, welcome to the show. I feel like we haven't met before today, but no. I feel like I know you because I've spent the last few days binging Hiking with Kevin.
Okay, cool.
And it feels like a lot of for one, I'm very jealous of your guest list. You get really great guests on the show.
Thank you.
But also it's just this. There's very like serene, relaxing feeling that I get from
yeah,
watching
really
the show.
And, you know, I was wondering why I was so tired. It's because you were binging that show of me hiking. All of a sudden,
it's
like,
a lot of hiking.
Why am I so tired?
Nice to watch and sit on your couch you don't actually have to be hiking to watch the show.
No, you could be eating lunch or having a candy bar or whatever. But I've been very lucky with my guest list. Yeah, they have I went through all my friends. They did.
Yeah.
And now I'm like contacting publicists.
Yeah, that's a little different than just asking your friends to go on a hike.
It's actually how I got my publicist today. Is I contacted them to get a guest.
Yeah,
and then they reached out to see if I needed publicity. And I said sure.
Yeah, why not?
Wow.
So how did this idea for this YouTube show Hiking with Kevin kind of start?
Well, you know what, Matt, I there's a canyon near my house. I like to walk in and hike, and that's where I do all my meditating and thinking and writing. It's when I'm walking. I don't go into an office and sit down and write. When I'm walking, my mind is a lot more open to ideas coming in and out. So I called a friend of mine, Matthew Modine, the actor Matthew Modine, who's in Full Metal Jacket, and he's on Stranger Things now. And I say, hey, Matt, you want to go for a little hike? He goes, sure. So he comes up, and we go for a hike. And it's kind of an arduous hike. You know, it's a big loop, and it's pretty steep. And we're almost at the top. We're both out of breath, and we're catching up because we haven't seen each other for a while. And our sentences are fragmentated because we're so out of breath, you know. And it's like, Matt, how have you been? Did you, when you first came to, is that like, and I thought this would be funny if I was interviewing him and I videotaped it and you could understand what either one of us was saying. So that was funny. And then on the backside of the canyon, I asked him a few more questions. Seriously, I said, Matt, you ever turned down anything that you regretted? And he rolled his eyes. He goes, oh, man, after Full Metal Jacket, it was such a big hit. I turned down so many things. I turned down Back to the Future, the Michael J. Fox role.
Wow.
I turned down Top Gun, the Tom Cruise role, Wall Street, Charlie Sheen. I turned down Big, the Tom Hanks role.
And you were like, this is good stuff. I should be recording this.
I know it. And I was. And I said, I turned down all those too, but it was after they had done them.
I think so. Was it a kind of thing where you were going on hikes with people and not recording them?
Mostly, I hiked alone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, on occasion I would hike with somebody once in a while. But whenever I notice people passing me on the trail, you know, couples or whatever, they're always in these deep conversations, you know?
Yeah.
Things that they probably wouldn't, conversations they wouldn't have with their partner, but they were talking to with their friend. And that kind of, as I look back on that, I think there's something about hiking where you're not having eye contact and you're outdoors and you're exercising, where I don't know if it's the endorphins or what, but you're much more open and revealing.
Yeah, you definitely get some good stuff out of these people that I think they wouldn't share with, you know, say me or some other interviewer.
No, I can't see anybody sharing anything with you because, you know, you have that kind of look like, you know, I'm gonna screw them over.
And the selfie stick must have been a big a part of it, revelation
it
as well, because the whole thing is shot on a selfie stick in this kind of very lo-fi
setup. I originally
setup.
Started with a selfie stick and my iPhone.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were writing comments like, get a Steadicam. You can afford it. Come on. get an external mic, you know, with a windsock on it. It's too windy. Because, you know, I would do some hikes. Like I hiked with Michael Keaton and half of the hike was wind. You know, I couldn't use half of it. And it's funny, too, when I get to the hiking site to this day, my guests will say, where's the crew? I say, no, it's just me. I have the cell. And then they realize it's a real low-budget operation. But
do they like that?
Because they do like it.
There's less people around.
Yeah,
it
less
feels
people,
a little more private.
Yeah,
or
less people tugging on them and, you know, doing retakes. And, but now I have this this really nice rig that this guy sent me from Evo Gimbals. It's a carbon graphite selfie stick.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty light. And then there's a GoPro at the end of it. And then an external mic with like, they call it a dead cat, you know, a covering over it, like a furry covering that stops the wind.
Is that what you, so that's what you use for season three?
Season two and three. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think by the time this podcast comes out, season three will have come out. Do they come out one by one or all?
Every Thursday. September 5th.
Yeah. Great.
That is every Thursday until I run out of gas.
Do you, so you've already shot a bunch of them for this?
Shot about 10 of them, yeah.
Can you share any of the names or is it
a
secret?
One of the things I like to do is I like to make it a surprise each week. Mm-hmm. And I put a little tease on my Instagram and Twitter and people have to guess who my hiking guest is going to be the next day. So that's always been fun. So, you know, if I told you who they were, I wouldn't have to kill you, but it would take away the surprise. It'd be a spoiler alert. But there's some really good ones. People that I've been trying to get for a while.
Yeah.
And now that the show is taking off, they want to do it. People want to do it now. I get a lot of calls from publicists.
Yeah. Is it hard to convince people to go on hikes? Are there people that don't want to do that?
Some are. And then there's some people that will go, but it's got to be flat, they said. I call those my flatliners. Like Spade. David Spade would go, but it had to be perfectly flat.
No incline at all.
Not even on the 1% incline. He noticed it and he goes, aren't we going uphill a little bit now?
One of your early guests was Caitlyn Jenner.
Yeah.
That was how did you land Caitlyn Jenner as a guest?
I bought her flowers.
Yeah.
No, I used to know Bruce Jenner, you know, when he was around. And I knew him for a long time. He was like one of the first people I met in L.A., you know, and I wouldn't seek him out. I would just run into him at different events and functions and stuff. And I only met Caitlyn Jenner like, you know, a year ago. And somehow she knew me.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, we talked and I told her about my hike and she thought it was a good idea. And so we hiked.
Yeah.
And my favorite question for her was, Caitlyn, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would you change?
And she took you seriously, I think.
She did, actually.
Yeah.
She set her nose. Is there anything about you you would change?
Well, my nose, which is not.
I'm just kidding. Is there anything left to change?
Is there nothing left to change? I'm done.
And then another one that I really enjoyed was the Al Franken interview, which I think was one of the first interviews that he's really done since he left the Senate, was with you on a hike.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure, but he was very, you know, still raw from everything that went down. And, you know, he was still and probably still is kind of, you know, recoiling from all that and kind of, you know, getting back on his feet. It was almost like we went out for lunch afterwards, and this was just a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like he had, you know, he's going through a breakup with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of staring off sometimes and, you know.
Yeah, it's like breaking up with the Senate.
Yeah, kind of doubting himself because he loved what he did and he was really good at it.
Yeah.
And, and a lot of people are saying that he left too soon. You know, he should have stayed. And so I don't know if he's kind of regretting leaving so quickly, but, you know, it was the situation at the time, you know, with Roy Moore, and it's almost like the Democrats had to throw, you know, a sacrificial lamb out there.
Yeah. Do you feel like he shouldn't have left?
I think he should have stayed longer and at least had a, you know, some kind of a congressional investigation or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about that after that New Yorker article came out as well, which really dug into the allegations and basically came to the conclusion that it wasn't as
but there was
bad
such,
as people made it out to be at the time.
Such fervor back then about everything and, you know, all of these cases coming up. So it was kind of like, you know, the Democrats would be tainted if this was going to start growing in any way. So, you know, he kind of thought that was best, I guess, for the Democratic Party to step down.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of alluded to some of that stuff in the episode on the hike, but it seems like you didn't really get into it too directly with him.
Well, he didn't want to talk about it too much because, you know, people will pick it apart and they'll get critical about it and, you know, they'll think that he, you know, whatever, wasn't sorry for what he did or, you know, trying to get out of it. So he wanted to make sure that there was no, you know, repercussions of that nature.
Are there any other, you know, guests that you have that you've had on the show that really surprised you in some way or were unexpected? That you got something out of them that you didn't expect?
Conan O'Brien was very forthcoming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about his long-running history of anxiety.
Yeah,
it's a thing in his family. It just runs in his family. And you know, other people are also, you know, very open. Like I said, when you go hiking out there, you kind of get open and you start revealing stuff. And sometimes people say, "Hey, man, let's not put that in," you know, at the end of the hike. And I'll say, "I put in what I want to put in."
Yeah, do you?
No, I'm very good about that. I mean, we hike for an hour at least, so there's plenty of material. We don't need everything we talked about.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's I mean, I'm often surprised at how fit somebody is.
Yeah.
You know, like Molly Shannon was incredible, hiking shape.
Mm-hmm. Who was the most out of shape guest you've
besides
had?
Me? I would say probably Spade, only because he's got, like, you know, neck problems and he's hypoglycemic and stuff like that, you know. And then also, you know, these are my flatliners, people that like to hike flat. So, you know, sometimes they'll show up with a cup of coffee, like Bobcat Goldthwait, you know, or...
the coffee hike. That's very L.A.
Hike. Yeah. Howie Mandel never hiked before in his life, he said.
Really?
He had to go out and buy all the clothes. So he bought stereotypical hiking clothes. Yeah.
Do you have a dream guest? Maybe it's someone who's coming up in season 3 or someone else that you really you've always wanted to get on the show?
Everybody I ask is a dream guest.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't ask them if I didn't dream of having them on the show. But, you know, sure, there's people like, you know, I'd love to have Oprah on there and, you know, any of the Obamas. Controversial people, too, would be good. I'd like to have more athletes on the show, quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Aaron Rodgers and, you know, whomever, and basketball players.
Mm-hmm.
Stephon Curry, and maybe singers.
You played football growing up, right?
I played football in college.
College.
And I played growing up too, but not organized, not in high school, because we were always moving, and I was in different high schools. But we played sandlot football in our neighborhood, and that was really tough. We had the equipment, you know, and the helmets and all that stuff, and shoulder pads, and we played this gang from across town at the local high school football field, like on a, you know, on a Sunday. And we had no refs, so it was tackle. And so it was pretty tough. And so in college, a buddy of mine who I used to play with found out that if we took a night course in criminology at Fairfield University, that'll qualify us to play in their club football team.
Oh, yeah.
So we did that, and the starting quarterback got hurt, so I filled in for him, and I was the quarterback for the whole season. It was great. It was like a fantasy thing.
And at that point, were you already kind of interested in comedy, getting involved in comedy?
Yeah, I loved comedy. And I mean, I've always loved comedy. I grew up watching the Jerry Lewis movies and following stand-ups. I used to love to watch them on the talk shows. Mm-hmm. I would look at the TV guide. That's kind of what you went off of back then. And I would highlight every comedian. I would look at all the talk shows that were on, mm-hmm. you know, like Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas. And I look at The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I'd see all the comics and I'd highlight them. And I'd be there to watch them mm-hmm. because I thought it was such an interesting craft that they come out with no tools, just, you know, in their outfit. And then they talk. Mm-hmm. And make people laugh 5 minutes and then they're done, you know. And it's kind of verbal misdirection comedy, you know. And
yeah.
I thought that was so cool. So I kind of got into that then, and there was also in the back section of, there was a newspaper, a magazine called the Parade Magazine. It usually mm-hmm. came with the Sunday newspaper.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the back, it was a section called My Favorite Jokes, and it was by different comics at the time mm-hmm. that were popular. Mm-hmm. And I would read those, and I memorize those, and I go to parties, you know, in the neighborhood, and I tell those like they were my own.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I take one, like a joke. And I really happened. I'd say, hey, man, did you hear about this guy today downtown? He stole a fire truck. And everybody's like, are you kidding me? Because a lot of my friends' fathers yeah. were firemen. I said, yeah, you didn't hear about it? And they said, what happened? They get him. I said, yeah, he was arrested like an hour later by some guy who stole a cop car. And so I liked that. And a friend of mine said, you should go into like one of those comedy clubs in New York, like the Catch Rising Star, and mm-hmm. do some stand-up. Of course, I had no material.
Yeah.
You know, I was just doing other people's jokes. So I went in there to check it out. And it terrified me because, you know, it was a New York crowd, and I wasn't used to mm-hmm. that. I grew up in Connecticut and kind of a, you know, bucolic neighborhood and area, bedroom community, you know, in this mm-hmm. New York now, I'm sitting in a room that's a little bit bigger than this room. They're crammed with people and everybody's smoking. The comics mm-hmm. are on stage, Richard Belzer, you know, all these comics that were kind of tough New Yorkers, Barry Diamond. And I thought, man, this is just too brutal here in New York. I heard California, they're more laid back, right?
Yeah.
You always hear California's laid back and there's more prop comics or whatever out here, you know, like Steve Martin and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I came out here and tried it.
So you didn't actually get up on stage in
no.
New York? You just went and watched.
Yeah, but I came out yeah. here, and then eventually I went back. Little did I know I'd be on Saturday Night Live one day.
Yeah.
In New York.
So what do you remember about those first times getting on stage to do stand-up?
Oh, it was not only being on the stage, it was the lead-up to it, how terrified you were all just thinking about it the whole time and, you know, looking at your material and learning your jokes and hoping they're good. And then going to the open mic nights and waiting in line and getting there, you know, early and then... By the time you get on stage, you know, the MC was doing so many favors for people. You get on like at, you know, 1:30 in the morning mm-hmm. or 1:45, right before they close, and there's just a few drunk tables left. But it was, you know, after the first time I got on at the Improv in Hollywood, I was hooked. You know,
yeah.
that was the stage where Freddie Prinze used to perform and, you know, Albert Brooks, all these people, you know, Richard Pryor. And so it became my life. That's all I ever did was stand up, and I would be down at the Improv every night, and eventually I got a job bartending there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go on, if somebody didn't show up, I'd go on stage, you know. And when people came into town to visit me, they'd say, where can you take us? I said, I could take the Improv. That's all I know. You know, I know there's a Chinese theater over there. You could try to find out where that is, but I'm all about the Improv. You know?
Yeah.
I pretty much live there.
What was your early material like? Was it more one-liners or stories?
It was kind
or...
of based on the material that I kind of learned from, you know, the Parade section, My Favorite Jokes, and mm-hmm. watching other comics. It was very raw. When you first start out doing stand-up, that was the interesting thing about going to the clubs back then, the open mic nights. Everybody's emulating somebody that they knew. And back then, stand-up was still a novelty. A lot of people had never been to a comedy club before.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the comics were mostly Jewish, Black, and Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny now, it's like everything. It's, you know, Armenian and Indian and Saudi Arabian and Iranian. You know, it's mm-hmm. everybody
yeah.
in the world is doing stand-up now. And so people were doing like Richard Pryor
mm-hmm.
or they were doing Steve Martin or mm-hmm. Woody Allen. You know, there's
yeah.
the Black, the
yeah.
whites, and the
yeah.
Jewish right
Everyone's
there.
Kind of doing your impression of the famous comedians.
Yeah, yeah. And then so, you know, you start out doing that until you develop a style.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out your voice, what you want to say. And so I was doing jokes like, oh, man, I live in a bad neighborhood. But, you know, it's funny because the people that steal from you are kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I came home, my car was up on 4 cinder blocks. They had taken all 4 of my tires. And then I opened up the trunk, and the spare tire's gone, but they left me a spare cinder block. So it's that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And your big break obviously came going on Johnny Carson.
Yeah, I don't know if it was my big break because mm-hmm. I had done Letterman before that.
Oh, okay.
And I had done some of the local afternoon talk shows like Merv Griffin and Michael mm-hmm. Douglas.
But, I mean, it was a big deal when you went on
It was
on
a
Johnny
big deal
Carson.
Because he was the guy. If you did his show, that validated you as a comic. It was like passing your bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only game in town. He was the late night guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he was Johnny. He wasn't some comic that just got, you know, ordained to be a talk show host and it's got a couple of years under his belt. This guy had been doing it since he took over for, was it Steve Allen or whoever he took over for. And to please him would be great. So I auditioned for that show a couple of times when I shouldn't have. You know, it was too early in my career. Mm. And I had sweat coming out of me that I never had come out of me before, like behind my knees, you know, when I was auditioning.
Yeah.
And finally, this guy, Jim McCauley, was a segment producer at the time, and he never passed me. I did it like two or three times. And whenever he was in the room at a comedy club, people were terrified.
Mm-hmm.
They either canceled because they thought that they weren't ready, or they wanted to get on.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had seen me a few times, but then he was auditioning people for a show, Michael Nesmith, who used to be in the Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
He was producing a comedy sketch show. And I said, well, this time I'm just going to do the stuff that I think makes me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, not what I think the Tonight Show will like.
Yeah.
And so I did what I liked, and he called me the next day. He goes, yeah, I got good news and I got bad news. The bad news is I don't think you're right for the Mike Nesmith show, but I think what you did last night is great for the Tonight Show.
Wow.
Can you do it on Monday? And this was Friday. So I had to like, you know, and from that minute on, I just started going over my act in my head.
Yeah.
Like over, I could be talking to you now and you think I'd be listening, but I'm going over my act.
Yeah.
And so cut to Monday, I come out and do the Tonight Show and I'm there, I'm behind the curtains, ready to come out. And I know exactly what it is because I used to go to that show and watch it because
mm-hmm.
they would give out free tickets
mm-hmm.
and they give everybody two tickets. So I would go down that line around 4 o'clock in the afternoon and very sympathetic. Does anybody have an extra ticket? I'd always get one.
Yeah.
And it was like going to a Vegas show. You would see, you know, you see him come out. He'd say hi to the audience. The producers would come out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Doc Severinsen, the band leader, would come out and say hi. And they'd do the same jokes, you know. And then and I knew each band member. I knew their personalities because I went so many times. So now I'm standing behind the curtain. And I know we're coming back from commercial. I know that band's going to wind down with all their horns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny's going to introduce me. And that's what happens. And the curtains open up. And I'm walking out. And they're applauding. Johnny's to my right, and I totally went blank. I couldn't remember my act.
Yeah.
And I walk all the way out there, nothing. I'm just, it's like a ghost town in my head. You know, I was so scared.
It's terrifying.
And as after the last clap happened, I remembered my act, and I started going into it, and people are laughing. There's applause breaks. And at the time, I'm thinking, it's like I have two conversations. One is that, because I know it so well. And the other one is, I'm on the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
I'm killing. I'm on a break right now because they're applauding, and Johnny's laughing. I could hear him. And I finish, and I wave, and I quick look over to Johnny. He gives me the okay signal, and I go behind the curtain, and Jim McCauley, the talent producer's behind there, and he's smiling. He's all happy, and he goes, you did great. You did great. Stay here now, because I think Johnny's going to want to talk to you on a panel after the commercial.
After a break. Usually it's he would either call you over immediately, or that was it, right? Is that what was in your head, was maybe he'll call me over?
I thought I had a great set.
Yeah.
I didn't get called over, but that's okay. I had a great set. And then, so he called, you know, he brings me out after the commercial. He says, you know, we've run out of time. We don't have enough time to bring out our next guest. And, you know, so let's bring out that young man, Kevin, that was just, you know, so I come out there. And then I had like a couple of jokes in my pocket, really strong jokes that I killed with. And he's throwing his head back laughing. I could see a little cigarette smoke coming out from the break, you know, it's still in his lungs. And it was just the highlight of my career. Nothing really kind of superseded that. Even, you know, Saturday Night Live or Weeds or anything else.
Yeah.
That was like, that was the thing that gave me the most excitement.
How did it change your career, that experience?
It didn't change it overnight. I mean, I think it kind of, you know, made people open their eyes because I didn't, after I did it and before it aired, I had never been so high, you know, a natural high of just walking on clouds. And back then, everybody at the Improv would come out to the bar to watch your first shot on The Tonight Show. Because I had been part of that crowd watching other people.
Yeah.
And it's a little TV over the bar at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the home room would get quiet. And they would, you know, Johnny would announce you to come out, and then people would be watching. And then they'd see it, and they'd be, you know, excited. And I wasn't there because, I went over to a friend's house who helped, you know, who I used to write with a little bit. And we watched it in his living room. And but you knew people were watching, and then I got all these messages on my, you know, answering machine at home.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, you had these, you know, these audio cassette messages, and I saved them all, and I still have them to this day. Different comics call me, like Paul Reiser and Brad Garrett.
That's great.
And Gary Shandling and Bob Saget, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was really, I have never duplicated that career-wise, that feeling.
Coming up, how Kevin Nealon ended up on Saturday Night Live and how he knew it was time to leave. I mean, the next thing obviously is SNL, you know, comes up. Was that something that was always a dream of yours, or was it something that sort of wasn't on your radar as a possibility, or how did you think about it?
Well, that's a good question. It wasn't really on my radar because I knew I'd never get on there because I didn't do impressions or characters, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
But, and I always knew when they came through town to look at people, comics, you had to really have a high-powered agent to mm-hmm. get you an audition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was just kind of doing the open mics, and I'd done a couple of Tonight shows. And no, I was doing, like, I was doing some road work now. It wasn't just open mics. It was, like, club. I was getting some club spots and because I'd done the Tonight Show. And Dana Carvey, who I shared a house with in the Hollywood Hills when he was in town. He lived over the garage. He recommended me. He got on the show that summer.
Yeah.
I was really excited for him. I was reading Backstage Live, you know, the original mm-hmm. book, SNL. And out of the blue, he calls me. He goes, "Hey, Kev, I'm out at Lorne Michaels' house. You know, they're still looking for one more cast member." Mm-hmm. And I told him about you. Oh, first he goes, "Guess who's in the kitchen? Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd." I said, "You're kidding me." He goes, "No." Anyway, he says, "Looking for one more cast member." I told him about you, and I think Lauren's going to want to see your audition tapes. I said, "Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd in the kitchen?" I didn't even hear the other stuff. It didn't register because I knew I'd never get on that show because I didn't do characters like Dana or impressions. Mm-hmm. I was just a stand-up, a really, really good stand-up.
Yeah.
So I sent them in, you know, what it hurt. And then a couple weeks later, Dana calls me back. He goes, "Kevin, back out of Lorne Michaels' house. Guess who's in the kitchen? Steve Martin." I said, "You're kidding me." He goes, "No." "Anyway, Lauren liked your tapes. I think they're going to fly you in for an audition." I said, "Steve Martin is in the kitchen." So next thing I know, I'm flying in for this audition, and I'm going to 30 Rock. To me, it's just a free trip to New York. That's all. I know I'll never get out there because I'm not going to whip out all these characters and you know, impressions. So I show up to 30 Rockefeller Plaza. I go up to Studio 8H, and I do my audition. And the minute I walked in there, I got really tired because whenever I watched that show, I used to fall asleep. You know, it sounds so late.
It was like an associative.
So it was an associated kind of a feeling there. But I did my little audition, and I flew home thinking, okay, that's that. You know, forget about that. That was interesting. And 2 weeks later, I found myself, you know, sitting across from Lorne Michaels in a high-rise in Beverly Hills. He's offering me a job on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, he came out to L.A. to offer you the job.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And I said, "Well, thank you very much, Lorne. Let me think about it over the weekend." That's the way I roll. That's the way I negotiate. That's how I get to... How do you think I got on this show today, The Daily Beast? Come on.
Yeah.
And he saw right through me. He goes, "Well, you think about it over the weekend. We'll see you in New York on Monday." So the next thing I know, I'm out at Lorne Michaels' house. And I get a call from Dana. He goes, "Kev, I'm in the back bedroom at Lorne Michaels' house. Guess who's in the kitchen?" I said, "I'm in the kitchen, that tough guy." Because I showed up, basically. You never know what's going to happen if you show up.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there is it's interesting, you know, talking about being a stand-up on that show, because there is an interesting history, I think, of stand-up versus sketch people on that show, you know, thinking about Eddie Murphy was a stand-up, you know, there's,
yeah, well,
there's
when
been
I got
a lot
on,
of
there was
stand-ups.
Dennis Miller was a stand-up, and Victoria Jackson was kind of a stand-up. Mm-hmm.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Alty and Dana and me.
Yeah.
And he was just looking for chemistry that year. Because the year before, you know, it was kind of a disastrous year. Even though the actors were talented, there was no synergy, I don't think, with the writers. You had Robert Downey Jr. on and Anthony
That
Michael
was the
Hall.
Year right before you started.
So, you know, we never really were... confident that the show would last. We thought, you know, we lived out of our suitcase week to week, thinking it was going to get canceled. And it was such a high...
Not thinking you were going to get fired, thinking the show was going to get canceled.
Yeah, thinking the show was going to get fired. You know? So gradually it kind of worked its way back. And I remember people ask me sometimes, were you really nervous going on there the first time? Because, you know, I said, well, basically I'd been working in front of live crowds doing stand-up. So it wasn't, you know, the Tonight Show was terrifying for me. But this was kind of like, in a way, I pretended nobody's watching anymore because of the year before. The ratings were so low. And I remember the first sketch I did on there was a sketch called Mr. Subliminal that I wrote.
Yeah.
And it's like two conversations going on at once. So it takes a lot of focus.
Yeah.
And I'm getting ready to go on. And the sketch is maybe, you know, maybe, I don't know, about a half hour into the show or so. And we're coming back from commercial, like 10 seconds. And Lorne Michaels comes up to me, puts his hand on my shoulder. And he goes, are you sure this is what you want? And that's his way of kind of loosening up, you know?
Yeah.
And from then on, I had no problem with it, you know? And I just pretended nobody else was watching the show except for the people in the studio audience.
Yeah.
And half of them were maybe like, you know, talking on the phone to somebody. Yeah.
Where did Mr. Subliminal come from? Was that something that you had done in your stand-up?
That was
in your
my act. Yeah. It was called tagging. And that actually came about. There was a guy, like I said, I used to hang out at the Improv, so I met a lot of interesting characters, creative people, actors. And there was this guy, Ed Peck, who was he was probably in his 70s at the time, but he was had a really deep voice, and he was a character actor, and he was on shows like Laverne and Shirley. He played the cop, you know, on Happy Days. And he took to me. He really liked me a lot. And one night he goes, let's go to Cantor's. You know, let's go to the deli after this, when you get off work. I said, I want to show you a thing I'm doing called tagging. So we go in and we sit down in the booth, and he was kind of doing a subliminal thing, not to try to get something he wanted, but just try to slip words in. So the waitress, like, he would say, oh, let's see, I think I'm going to have, he said to the waitress, I think I'm going to have the cheeseburger whore. And also, why don't I have a, you know, and he'd do all this profanity stuff. Yeah. And the waitress never picked up on it. So when I got to Saturday Night Live, I got together with Al Franken, and we wrote subliminal based, because I went to school for advertising and marketing, and he knew about subliminal advertising too. So we thought, let's insert words to get your way, you know, and have, you know, get the Mets tickets, you know, go to a restaurant and have somebody else pick up the tab, you know.
Did it start as a Weekend Update desk bit, or was it
No, it started as a sketch.
Yeah, but you also did it on Weekend Update,
Yeah, and then
Update,
we kind of moved it over to Weekend Update,
I just want to take a moment here, if I may, to clear up some confusion. For a number of years, I was a cast member here at Saturday Night Live, but I haven't been since 1995, some 6 years ago. And yet, some people still come up to me and say, Mr. Nealon, it's Saturday. Shouldn't you be getting out to New York for the show? Oh, hey, Mr. Nealon, you were funny on the show last night. Love that Mr. Subliminal. And then I have to explain that I'm not on the show anymore. What you're watching are reruns on Comedy Central. You see, I'm not a part of this cast, Overrated. I don't even know these people. I really don't. And to be honest with you, I have no connection whatsoever with this show anymore, lawsuits. In fact, I have not seen Lorne Michaels in like 4 years, restraining order. And quite frankly, it takes everything I have to stay up this late right now, coked up. So once again, recapping. I am no longer on this show. I'm off doing bigger and better things now, Hollywood Squares. I guess you could say that, I guess you could say I moved on, Trailer Park, and that's good.
Yeah, so when you got there, Dennis Miller was doing
Weekend Update. Yeah.
Was that, did you have your eye on that
Not
role?
At all.
As a stand-up, I mean, that's, again, where a lot of, I think, stand-ups have ended up, is in that role.
Yeah, not at all. That was Dennis's thing. That's all he did. He didn't really do sketches. Except for one that he wrote called LeBeau. I forget the name. That was one of the characters, LeBeau. It was a real surreal kind of a sketch.
Yeah.
Really funny, though. So that was his thing. And I was more focused on learning how to write sketches and do characters and you know, things of that sort. And Dennis did the Weekend Update for, I don't know, was it 6 years maybe?
I think it was about five seasons in before you took over.
Was it? Okay, yeah. And I did it for 3 seasons. I always liked the way Chevy Chase did it, kind of as a dry newscaster, you know, and everybody brings their own persona to that Weekend Update desk now, you know, and people don't do it as a Weekend Update anchorman anymore, really. They do it as themselves. And it's almost like they're doing their stand-up up there, you know.
Yeah, that's not how you approached it?
That's not how I saw it. You know, I didn't see it as a mini special that you're doing.
Yeah.
I saw it as, you know, this is the news anchor. You know, he's trying to be, it's almost like Anchorman, the movie, you know. And so that's how I chose to do it. And people since then have done it differently, of course, you know. Colin Quinn did it his way, and Norm did it his way, and you know, everybody has their own way of doing it. But I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was a lot of work too. You know, I have to write jokes now too. Also, and I was also I was doing sketches still too, and writing sketches and writing jokes on. And you would only write jokes on Saturday morning because they'd all been picked over before then by the late night talk show host.
Yeah, you know, that's still that's still the case. I think. Yeah. Do you feel like, I know people talk about how, you know, you said you were always worried it was going to, the show was going to get canceled. People are always worried at SNL that they're going to get fired. And there's a lot of pressure to get your stuff on. Did getting Weekend Update change that for you, or you thought, okay, now I'm kind of more comfortable here?
I don't think you ever get really comfortable or secure. I think getting that job, you know, was almost another layer of fear of getting fired because, oh, now you got the Weekend Update spot. How long are you going to last in that spot? You know, are you going to get fired like soon?
So the fear of getting fired never goes away.
Yeah, you're going to get fired within the show, you know, in one position.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, I did three years of that and then I was replaced with Norm Macdonald.
Yeah.
And then I left the following year.
Did that have anything to do with why you left or?
No.
No.
No, I had been there for eight seasons at that point. I'd do one more season after that, so nine. And I was kind of, I'd had my fill of it. Yeah. I appreciated the show. I loved the show. It was great. A lot of people use it as a stepping stone and want to score and get out and do movies. I just love that whole, you know, that whole notion of having a different guest every week as the host and getting to hang out with bands that I grew up listening to, like, you know, Mick Jagger and James Taylor and, you know, Paul Simon and Eric Clapton, all of these megastars and Aerosmith. Even I saw Roy Orbison on there.
Yeah.
You know? How great is that? I worked with Robert Mitchum, Charlton Heston, you know, all these people that were dinosaurs. So,
you just felt like it was time.
I felt that it was. I was even going out and doing sketches with food in my mouth from the craft service table. That's how lackadaisical I was about it. And I thought it's kind of time. And, and also, I think, you know, the cast had gotten so big, and they were looking to clean house. And I think the year I left, I was kind of pushed out too. You know, I know Farley was kind of fired and Sandler that year was fired. A lot of people were fired.
That was all the same year you left is when they left.
And I was essentially kind of forced out, you know. I knew they probably wouldn't bring me back if I wanted to. So I stayed for that one last year and I was able to line up something. I got offered a pilot that DreamWorks was doing. It was their first foray into a sitcom world. So it was Katzenberg and Spielberg and those guys. And so I thought that was a good stepping off point. It was called Champs with Timothy Busfield. So, you know, I did that. And so I had my run on SNL and it was fun. I really loved it. You know, a lot of people complain about the show, but I loved it. Yeah. I loved the, you know.
At the time you left, I mean, after nine seasons, you were the longest running cast member ever at the time. Now people have gone much longer than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I get it too. I mean, stay there. You have a job and it's fun. It's New York and you get to, you know, it's live. I mean, how great to have that had that experience. I mean, I'm always grateful for that.
Yeah. How crazy is it that Chris Farley and Adam Sandler got fired from SNL looking back?
It is crazy looking back. But, you know, like I said, at the time, there were so many people on there. I remember initially I came on with Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks, you know, Nora Dunn was still there and Dennis and Dana and John Lovitz. And it was a tight, I think there was like eight of us. And I wasn't even a regular cast member in the beginning. The first year I was a feature player and a writer.
Yeah.
And then they made me a cast member the next year. But so from that eight, they started bringing in other people like Mike Myers and Chris Rock and, you know, Spade and all these people. And other people that didn't really stick with it, like Janine Garofalo, Ben Stiller, you know. And then, but, you know, Michael McKean came
Sarah Silverman.
Sarah Silverman, yeah. And it just became a huge, just whatever stuck to the wall, you know. And so, you know, Don Pardo was doing the intros for like a half hour before the show started. So, you know, the writing was on the wall. I had been there for a while. They saw all my tricks, you know, everything. And I got it. You know, I really didn't want to stay any longer. I had my fill of it.
Yeah, I mean, stand-up has been a constant in your life, you know, the whole time. You've been doing it for, what, 40 years now, I think?
Almost, yeah.
Yeah. What are the sort of, you know, biggest lessons that you've learned about what it is to be a stand-up over that amount of time?
Well, it's kind of what I've learned about life. It's how fast it goes. I remember walking around town here, you know, people ask me, how long have you been doing stand-up? Because that's always the question when you're kind of new on the scene. How long have you been doing it?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it seemed like it was always 4 years.
Yeah.
I've been doing it 4 years, about 4 years. Yeah, 4 years. And now it's 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, and that went by like nothing. But the thing that I learned that I tell like a lot of young comics that are starting out, if they ask for advice, I say, you know, get up as much as you can, as often as you can, so you're relaxed on stage, and just write all the time and be original and unique. Because more so now than when I started, there's zillions of comics out there, and there's a lot more platforms too. So you've got to stand out somehow. You got to, I mean, you can have great material and that'll get you pretty far, but unless you're really unique, you know, you're not going to go. And the people I like, just before I came on to do stand-up, it was people like Andy Kaufman, who was really unique and different and interesting, and Albert Brooks, who had a great spin on things, and Steve Martin, who was very original. So I like that whole thing. I'm not. It's not to say that there's not a place for people who just do a monologue that are really funny, but there's a lot of people that do that are really good. So I say, try to think of something that'll make you stand out from the pack.
Do you feel like you've continued to grow, get better, evolve over all this time? I mean, do you feel like you reach new revelations about it or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I have like not really any fear anymore of going on stage.
That must be nice.
It is nice in a way, but you should have a little bit of nervousness or fear, you know, but I'm totally dead inside now. And also, I recognize that I'm not a 25 or 26-year-old guy that's doing stand-up where I'm out in the clubs every night because I'm single and I don't have any overhead.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a family. I can't do that. I can't be out doing three or four shows a night at the Improv and then running over to the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory, which I see happening. I look at the lineups on, you know, that are posted, and it's like the same comics that are working every night. Ali Wong, Chris D'Elia, Joe Rogan, you know, it's like, and they're pounding it and they're coming out with specials every year, you know?
Yeah.
To me now, it's almost like a hobby because I get out maybe once or twice a week and do stand up and I'll try a couple new jokes, but it's not like I'm, you know, paving a new highway of comedy for myself.
How did becoming a father affect your comedy, do you think?
Well, anytime there's a new kind of wrench thrown into the works, you think about it a lot and you start writing about it and you talk about it. But I'm not one of those people like a Bill Cosby or like you know, someone who talks about their kids a lot. I'll have a couple of jokes about it. But I will tell you that my comedy has really taken a turn for the dark.
Yeah.
You know, I've really kind of, I don't know, maybe it's an age thing, but it's really become, it's not cringe comedy, but it's just dark. It's looking at things in a dark way. You know, like, I talk about, you know, losing friends. Because, you know, after a certain amount of time on this planet, you start losing friends. And, so I talk about that, like, you know, I had a friend that was diagnosed with, you know, with terminal illness. He had 3 months to live. So we were all shocked. So we threw a party for him. You know, we saluted him. We toasted him, and, you know, we hugged him and danced with him even, and just told him how much we loved him. And then we said goodbye to him basically. And, you know, that 3 months came and went quicker than any of us had expected. And he was still alive. And then 4 months, still alive, 5 months. And now he's embarrassed that he's still alive. And we're like, hey, man, we spent a lot of money on that party for you. You know, so it's dealing with that kind of stuff. You know, that kind of stuff, which what goes through my head. You know, you just have to deal with what's going through your head and you write about it and you put a spin on it.
Coming up, Kevin tells a great story about what it was like to play the straight man opposite Chris Farley in the iconic Chippendales sketch on SNL.
Before we wrap up here, what I want to do is kind of go through some of the things we didn't get to talk about, and if there's kind of one story or memory that comes to mind when I mention these different moments in your career. One of your early movie roles was as drunk number two in Roxanne with Steve Martin, who I know was one of your heroes. So what was that? What did that mean to do that fight scene with Steve Martin in Roxanne?
That was the coolest experience because that was the summer that I got SNL.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I think I got hired to do that movie before I got SNL. And so it was great for many reasons. We went up to British Columbia to shoot it at a place called Nelson, where you had to fly in a little, you know, prop plane. And it was a ski town. And I never heard of this place before. And it was what you saw in the movie. It was just very bucolic and kind of romantic. And I had that one scene there where we're dueling, but me and Rich Scheidner, the other comic, was drunk number one, we were there for 3 weeks. So we just hung out. We rode mountain bikes. You know, we went to the gym, and then we shot our scene with him. And also, we did a stand-up show for the firemen, the local firemen there.
Oh, really?
We did a fundraiser because there was a lot of comics on that movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, Damon Wayans. There was Steve Middleman, me, Rich Scheidner, and a few other comics. And so we put together a fundraiser at the local dance hall there. And Steve got wind of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, hey, maybe I'll MC. Well, you want me to MC the thing? And he hadn't been doing stand-up.
Yeah, that's a
he
big deal.
He stopped doing stand-up for like 8 years or whatever. So he goes, but don't advertise it.
Mm-hmm.
And we go, okay. But it got, the word leaked out that he was doing it. And mm-hmm. there was a line wrapped around that building.
My God.
And people were driving up from the States to see him. And it was fun. You know, Daryl Hannah was sitting in the front row.
Yeah.
And so that was a really fun experience for me.
Mm-hmm. You played yourself on the Larry Sanders Show. I know. What was that like? And what did Gary Shandling mean to you as a friend and as a
comic?
Well,
Gary was a great friend of mine. He was a really close friend. I knew him forever. I met him when I first came out here, and he was kind of a mentor in a way to me. And we got to the point where we'd write together a lot on the phone late at night, and we hang out and played basketball at his house every Sunday. So we were really good friends, and I loved his show, the Larry Sanders Show. And I think I was on there once or twice, and it was fun because I knew him so well, and mm-hmm. he had great actors on there, great guests, and great writers. So that was a really fun time for me, and I think about him still every day.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a necklace that was given to me that has some of his ashes in it
mm-hmm.
that I'll wear around my neck sometimes. And I always wonder, what part of him is it? Is it his nose? Is it his penis? What's in there?
Another SNL moment that I wanted to touch on is the famous Chippendales sketch with Chris Farley
yeah.
and Patrick Swayze, which you play a pivotal role in as kind of the straight man, but kind of you get to deliver the punchline as well. What do you remember about filming that? Did it seem like that it would live on in the way it has when you were doing it?
Well, at the time you don't know what's going to live on because everything's happening so quickly
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to survive and, you know, you're doing your best. And that was definitely a sketch that kind of, you know, was just cemented the idea of Saturday Night Live and what it was all about back then. And that mm-hmm. was just one of those sketches that'll never go away. And that was fun doing it. I never really broke up on SNL. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it seems to be pretty commonplace now for them to break up.
Yeah,
you know,
laughing.
They get laughs.
Yeah.
And Lauren always says that was really hacky. It was like the Carol Burnett Show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Harvey Korman. No way. You know, they don't do that there. But so that probably was the closest I came to cracking up.
Mm-hmm.
But easy.
But you held it together.
I held it together. But it was easy, too, because back then you were trying to keep the show on, and you didn't want to fail and disappoint Lauren and laugh mm-hmm. and stuff. So you're out of fear. You didn't laugh, you know?
Well, we've made our decision. But before we tell you, I just want to say once again how truly difficult it was for us to make our choice and to thank you for your patience throughout this long, arduous audition.
Thanks.
We're going to go with Adrian.
I knew it, man. I'm sorry. I just never wanted anything so much in my life. And now that I got it, I just can't deal with it.
Well, that's okay, Adrian. We understand. Barney, we all agreed that your dancing was great. Your presentation was very sexy. I guess in the end, we all thought that Adrian's body was just much, much better than yours.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh, okay.
You see, it's just that at Chippendales, our dancers have traditionally had that lean, muscular, healthy physique, like Adrian's. Whereas yours is, well, fat and flabby.
And so, but yeah, I remember doing that and just being there with, it was me, Jan Hooks, Mike Myers, Patrick Swayze and Chris Farley. And sadly, all those people are gone now except for Mike Myers.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was fun. And in hindsight, I didn't know at the time, but I think Chris Farley was really reticent about whether he should do it or not. I think he was a little self-conscious about mm-hmm. his weight.
Showing his body in that
yeah.
way.
But I didn't know it at the time. I thought, here's a guy who just wants to get laughs. He doesn't care.
Fearless.
I don't know what happens. But he, you know, it's funny too about him is I'm always like impressed how these heavy people are so light on their feet and they have mm-hmm. good balance. And he was like that. He was like a good dancer. Mm-hmm. He could skate.
Yeah.
And you know, because he was athletic in college, he played rugby. And so, but that was, I think, one of the probably the most famous sketches on that show.
Yeah. We didn't really get to talk about Weeds, but that was 8 seasons, over 100 episodes. So, I mean, obviously you spent a lot of time on,
a lot of
on that show. Yeah. Got a lot of smoking pot. What stands out from your time on that show?
Well, when I left SNL and that show I went to, Champs, that sitcom didn't work, I started to think to myself, I wonder if I'll ever be on another show that will, you know, have some wings and people talk about, you know. And then Weeds came along and I was hired to be, passed the audition to be a guest star in the pilot. And then the pilot came out. And I went in to read for it, you know, I had to read for it, and I go into the dressing room, and there's a lot of, like, you know, well-known actors in there that, you know, are up for the role, too, and other people that just came into town. And it just was a fit for me. They, you know, Jenji Cohen, the creator, just kind of latched on to me and said, this is your perfect Doug Wilson. And I did the pilot, and I kind of forgot about it, and then we got a call saying the pilot got picked up, and they want you as a regular. I thought, sweet, you know? But I learned a lot in there. Mary Louise Parker, I was going to say Mary Tyler Moore, but Mary Louise Parker was, she's such a good actress. You know, I learned so much by watching her. Just like I'm learning a lot now from Matt LeBlanc being on I'm Able to Play.
Yeah.
I mean, these people are just, they're aficionados at their craft. I mean, because they've been doing it for so long. And I mean, like Mary Louise Parker, she'll deliver a line when she's angry, but she'll do it with a smile on her face. And I think, wow, that's interesting twist right there. That works, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm picking up a lot from that.
You were part of the SNL 40 show, which was a big moment.
Yeah.
You were on there with, you were up there with other Weekend Update hosts, and it was kind of framed as a tribute to Chevy Chase. There was kind of a, it was kind of an awkward vibe up there with the four of you guys. What did it feel like when you were doing it?
That show was so, like, quickly put together, and it was kind of it's like most SNL shows. You wonder how it ever came together, you know. And then it comes,
and
in
that's like the biggest one ever.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's Paul McCartney everywhere you look. It's like the Hollywood Wax Museum. You know? Everybody's there. Eddie Murphy and, you know, Dan Aykroyd. You know, all these people, and then. So the time came, we're supposed to get up on the stage there and we do our thing. And then I think Norm's supposed to introduce Chevy Chase, but Norm was just, you know, being Norm and just dilly-dallying and stuff.
And meanwhile, it's a live show.
Yeah. And then Chevy comes out and it was fun, though. It was fun hanging out with those guys and, you know, being up there. I mean, we were just a few of the many Weekend Up There anchors that were on that show.
Did you go to the famous after party?
Went to the after party, and it was at the Plaza Hotel, and I remember seeing Prince there, and he floated by with his whole, you know, posse, you know, shaved heads and stuff, and we had eye contact. He's very short, and he smiled, and I smiled. I say, Prince, how you doing? He goes, hey, how are you? And I put my hand out, and he shook my hand, and I introduced my wife, because my wife was a huge Prince fan, and, you know, they shook hands, and they moved on, and she goes, oh, my God, Prince never shakes hands.
Really? Because he was a germaphobe?
I guess. I don't know. But so that was fun. And Trump was there with Melania at the time.
Yeah.
And I see him, and I know Trump from when he was on SNL, you know, and hanging around and stuff. And I called him. I say, Trump! And he sees me, and he sees my wife. He goes, he smiles. He goes, Neilan, you did all right for yourself.
Oh, wow.
My wife is like, ugh, gross.
Yeah, what does she think about that now? This was before he was president.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah, Sarah Palin was there that night too, I think.
She was there. I went with my son for the rehearsal earlier in the day, and we go into a little green room there with Sarah Palin sitting there. And she's very nice, you know? She's just like a mother, and... And I say hi to her, and I introduce my son, and she starts talking to my son and being very motherly. And I think, well, she's really nice, you know. I think maybe, I wonder if she babysits.
So we end every episode by asking the guests, what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? So is there something that you can think of that really made you laugh recently?
Yeah, I can. It was like, it was from one of the hiking episodes, and my son loves it when I, like, lose control laughing. I mean, he'll look at me and he'll start laughing. He just loves it. It makes him so happy.
Yeah.
And I think that was the last time I laughed really hard. It was Alice and Janney. We were hiking, and I'm editing the hike. And there was a part where I said to her, have you ever worked with any divas? And she goes, yes, I have. I said, who? And she whispers in my ear, and I can't hear her. And I said, who? And she whispers again, I still can't hear her. I said, who? And she says it out loud. She goes, William Hurt, loud. And we both laughed on the hike together. But then when I watched it, it looked so insanely funny, and I couldn't stop laughing. And my son's just looking at me, and he's laughing, and he doesn't want it to stop.
That's great. Well, everyone should check out The Hiking Show, which is now back for season 3.
Yeah, every Thursday I post a new episode
on YouTube.
As long as I have the hikes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a lot of fun, and it was a lot of fun talking to you today.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Likewise.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Kevin Nealon for coming out and talking with me today. New episodes of Hiking with Kevin will appear on YouTube every Thursday. This past week's guest was Alec Baldwin, and he has a lot of other great guests coming up. And you can find Kevin's stand-up tour dates at kevinnealon.com. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!
I think we know the rest of the story.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.